This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. It's Friday once again, and that means it's time for our weekly news review. We've got lots to discuss this week, from an ethics complaint about a current Cincinnati City Council member and a plea agreement with a former City Council member, to Ohio's U.S. Senate race and the deaths of a dozen horses in a matter of weeks at Churchill Downs. We're going to start by talking about news that just became public this morning. Cincinnati City Council's newest member is under investigation after a fired employee in his office filed an ethics complaint. That comes after news broke earlier this week that former Cincinnati City Council member Jeff Pastor has agreed to plead guilty in his public corruption case. Joining me to discuss those stories and some other news this week are WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Welcome back, Becca.
Hello, Lucy.
And WCPO9 I-Team reporter Paula Christian. Thanks for being here, Paula.
Thanks, Lucy.
Becca, I want to start with you. Just this morning, you reported that Councilmember Seth Walsh is under investigation. You got a lot of detail in your story on WVXU.org, but tell us a little bit, what's the backstory here?
So rumors have been kind of floating around City Hall for a couple of weeks, ever since this particular council aide was fired about a month ago. So her name is Christina Allen. She worked in Seth Walsh's office starting in January up until the beginning of May. Now, as a reminder, Walsh is the newest member, as you mentioned. He is completing the term that Greg Landsman had. He went to Congress, so Seth Walsh was appointed to finish out that term, and he's now running for that election to win the seat in November. So there were sort of two separate issues here. One is the settlement that Christina Allen negotiated with the city solicitor's office for $30,000, in which she agrees not to sue the city over her termination or sue council either. Separate from that, Allen also filed a complaint with the city's Office of Ethics and Good Government, and that investigation is ongoing. But what was made public just today are some public records that I and a few other reporters in the city requested related to that ethics complaint and the settlement. And it really details some pretty specific allegations that she makes about the office.
Yeah. And we've been saying, calling her fired. This former aide to Councilmember Walsh says she was forced to resign. Does she say why in this documentation she got? Does she offer any reason that she was given for having to leave that job?
She does not offer specific, like, the council member told me this, but she believes it was in retaliation for bringing up concerns about political campaign activity happening on city time. Most of the allegations are centered around Walsh's now former campaign manager. She was just fired yesterday as a result of all of this information coming out. But Allen says that this campaign manager, Brianna Ledsam, was very involved in the council office from the very beginning in a way that made Allen uncomfortable, and that there were several things that she say crossed a line, including Ledsam, who is not a city employee, was only paid by the campaign, was kind of micromanaging city activities and events, and really kind of explicitly at times tailoring the aide's work to the campaign. So, like, one example would be Allen was sort of the community outreach person for Walsh's office. And one of the things was that she was tasked to visit all of the community councils between now and November before the election. Mm-hmm. And that led some sent her some priority specific election wards to prioritize. So specifically saying these are the areas where we need the most support and that's where you should visit first.
Explain this line between council members, city hall staffs, and campaign staffs. Why is it so important to keep those separate?
The line itself can be very blurry. I will say it is not at all uncommon for city staffers, for council aides to also work for either paid or unpaid for that council member's campaign. However, there are supposed to be pretty strict boundaries between the two. The idea is you don't want taxpayer money, paying for a political campaign, which is why it is, contrary to ethics to do that. All the council members and staff now sign a code of conduct saying they will not do campaign time. Sorry, that was a weird way to say that. They will not use city resources or staff to do campaigning. Now, just as an example, I'll say, like, other situations that I'm aware of, the meetings related to campaigns will happen outside of city, like, normal business hours. They won't happen at City Hall, that kind of thing. So in this case, you know, one of the things that Allen alleges is that there was a weekly staff meeting led by this campaign manager in her campaign office on Monday mornings during business hours that was required for council staff. So that's an example where Allen feels like, you know, a blurry line was made more clear, and that was definitely crossed.
Yeah. So what do you know about what this city office is looking into now? This investigation is not complete, as I understand.
That's correct. Yeah.
What do you know about what they're looking into?
So the office is relatively new. So this is the first time that you know, really the public has been aware of an investigation like this going on. So there's still a lot of questions that I think we have about that. Now, basically what this office is tasked with is looking at ethics violations and code conflict of interest laws, not just violations at the city level, but if there's, you know, there are state ethics laws as well, if those have been violated, or there's an allegation that those have been
violated.
Thank you. That would be part of the investigation as well. What we've seen so far in the documentation are it's basically everything that Allen included in her complaint, which are emails, some documents, screenshots of some text messages, basically trying to build her case. It includes a pretty detailed letter laying out the timeline from Allen's perspective. She had initially sent it to HR the day after she was fired or forced to resign. That later became part of the ethics complaint, and that's why it was released in the public record. So that's a good place to start folks are interested in learning more.
Yeah, and I know you have that embedded on our website at wvxu.org.
That's right.
You mentioned this $30,000 settlement that this former aide got. What are the possible outcomes for Councilmember Walsh, and what has he said about this whole situation?
He declined to do an interview. He did offer a short written statement basically saying he was not involved in negotiating the settlement. It was just between Allen, the former employee, and the city solicitor's office. I'm scrolling back up to this statement so I can read what else he said. He said, "I am singularly focused on continuing my efforts to help this city, especially those neighborhoods that have been left behind for so long." So he declined to answer any questions about, you know, from his perspective of how Letsam was or was not involved in his office. We really haven't heard anything from his side of the story at this point, and I think that's important to point out. But we did give him the opportunity to do that. And, you know, in terms of the future, he is has filed the number of signatures needed to be on the ballot in November, as have all the other Democrats on council. But what's the next interesting piece in this will be the endorsement process from the city Democratic committee, and whether or not they choose to endorse Walsh along with the other seven Democrats. And that endorsement maybe in the past has not meant as much, but in the last election, it resulted in 8 of 9 council seats going to endorse Democrats. And so it would be a pretty significant thing if the committee decided not to endorse him.
Yeah. So, Becca, what, if anything, does this have to do with the cases against former council members Tamaya Dennard, Jeff Pastor, and P.G. Sittenfeld?
So it's a very indirect connection, and it's important to note that the allegations here are not in any way like the allegations in those other situations. We're not talking about corruption, you know, of the type that we've seen in those cases. We're not talking about bribery, anything like that. And at this point, there's no allegation of criminal conduct either. But what's interesting is the reason that this ethics investigation is possible is because one of the things that council did after all those scandals in 2020 was to establish, first of all, requiring council and staff and the mayor's office too, by the way, to create and sign a code of conduct. And they also created the Office of Ethics and Good Government. So that's a very new office. Like I said, we haven't known a lot about investigations so far. So there's a connection there kind of indirectly that, you know, without this office, it wouldn't be possible for this ethics investigation to be continuing now. And I should just say, kind of as an aside, it was always possible for folks to file an ethics violation, or sorry, an ethics complaint with the Ohio Ethics Commission. And this complaint may end up there eventually anyway, but the local version of that is new.
Okay. Paula, I want to turn to you now. Former Councilmember Jeff Pastor changed his plea in his public corruption case, or at least announced his intent to change his plea earlier this week. Remind us of the accusations against former Cincinnati City Councilmember Pastor. What was he accused of doing?
He was accused of taking $55,000 in bribes from they were undercover FBI agents that were posing as developers that were seeking city help to revitalize Convention Place Mall. And they were embedded in City Hall for several years, 2018 and 2019, just kind of perusing around, trying to root out the corruption. And they ended up getting three council members on three separate corruption schemes, indicting all three. And Jeff Pastor was the last one to sign. Well, he will be known as convicted next week once the judge accepts his plea deal, but he did sign the plea deal this week.
Okay. And he was arrested before former council member P.G. Sittenfeld, if I'm remembering correctly, whose case already went to trial. What's been the delay with Jeff Pastor's case?
Well, Jeff Pastor originally had Ben Dusing as his attorney. And so Ben spent, you know, probably about a year invested in listening to the tapes, you know, going over the case, gathering the evidence, and then Ben had his own legal troubles with some complaints in the bar in both in Kentucky and Ohio, and he's currently suspended from practicing law. So that kind of left Jeff Pastor having to find a new attorney a year to a year and a half into his case, and it's a complicated case. So he went with the public defender's office, and you know, finally negotiated the plea deal.
And so I want to make sure we understand what happened this week. You said he indicated his that he signed the plea deal, and that's where we are now. And then the court will formally accept it next week. Is that where we are, or the week after?
Yes, he signed the plea deal. Judge McFarland will formally accept it on June 7th, which is really a formality. There's no reason why he wouldn't accept this plea deal. It doesn't happen very often anyways, but, you know, this plea deal is, you know, not something that would be rejected. It was interesting in what he negotiated in the plea deal, which, you know, will definitely lead to him serving much less prison time.
Tell us about that. Well, this, as I understand from your reporting, the plea deal mentions $15,000 specifically. What's the significance of that figure? Does that relate to the prison time you mentioned?
Yes. Well, in the indictment, I mean, he's charged with taking $55,000 in bribes and a trip to Miami on a private plane, a very expensive trip. So in the plea deal, he just admitted to taking $15,000, and he pled guilty to one charge, which is honest services wire fraud. And that's typical in plea deals. You know, you're trying to come up with a compromise. But one of the factors that the judge will look at when he is determining a sentence is how much loss. And so, for example, the fact that he took $15,000 in bribes versus $55,000 in bribes, you know, that will save him months, if not years, in prison. And if you're looking for any indication of how much time he'll serve, Tamaya Denard, another counsel person who pleaded guilty to the exact same charge, honest services wire fraud, she admitted to taking $15,000 in bribes. Judge DeLotte sentenced her in 2020 to 18 months in prison, and she ended up serving about a year of it.
Was this change of plea or this plea agreement, was this a surprise to you that it came to this? Because when Ben Dusing was Jeff Pastor's lawyer, as I remember, he talked a lot about really fighting these charges.
Yes, he sure did. But you know what happened in the meantime is P.G. Sittenfeld went to trial and he got convicted. And Larry Householder, the former Ohio House Speaker, and ex-GOP Chair Matt Borges went to trial, and they both got convicted. So, you know, the U.S. Attorney's Office is winning these public corruption cases. And, you know, in P.G. Sittenfeld's case, his case was a lot more indirect, and he had a much better chance of being exonerated. From what I understand, the evidence against Jeff Pastor is pretty explicit, especially what's on those tapes.
So when is the sentencing scheduled for?
The judge hasn't set the sentencing yet, but it's generally 3 months after the guilty plea, so which would put us into September. And after that, You know, the plea deal states that he won't serve any more than 2 years in prison, but it allows Jeff Pastor to try and make the argument for probation. So he's going to ask for probation or maybe house arrest. It's, in my opinion, very unlikely he's going to get that, because that's exactly what Tamaya Dennard asked for. And in some ways, she was a lot more sympathetic. And Judge Gillott just said, no, it's too serious of a crime. It had too much of an impact on our city. I'm sorry, but you are going to go to prison.
And former Councilmember Pastor has a co-defendant, too. What's the latest with him?
His co-defendant is Tyron Marshall. That was his friend and kind of business partner. He got tied up in this because apparently Jeff Pastor was using his LLC to sanitize the money to kind of so it didn't look like a bribe. It looked more like a donation to like a nonprofit that was helpful to people, but actually it was a bribe. He has not signed a guilty plea. There's not been any public movement in his case. He has a status conference scheduled for next week, right after Jeff Pastor's plea deal. So, you know, I can't imagine that he's going to go to trial alone. You know, probably another guilty plea will come out of that as well.
Interesting. Well, I know you've been following all this very carefully and closely. I really appreciate your sharing your perspective with us. Becca, I want to come back to you and talk a little bit about the city budget, which is one of the other 75 stories you've been following over the past couple of weeks. The city has a new Cincinnati Fire Department training center in the works. When did construction start on that?
Oh, well, that's a good question, because the groundbreaking, which in my opinion, I thought meant construction would start soon after, but not necessarily. The groundbreaking was last November, just before Thanksgiving. But even at that time, they said construction was not expected to start until fall 2023.
So the groundbreaking, quote unquote, was last November, but it's back to the design phase. What happened?
Basically, it came in over budget. So the city is kind of facing decisions about whether to go with a smaller footprint, a smaller design with, you know, not as much as the original plan, or to try to come up with the money to continue as planned. The city manager is saying that there has been another $2 million identified. It hasn't been approved by council yet. It's part of the mayor's kind of separate budget ordinance that will move forward in the next couple weeks. That's another $2 million, but we still don't know exactly how much the gap is. So I don't know if that would fill the gap or if that's just part of the puzzle.
Okay. Is it clear at all when construction could actually start on this?
Not at all. It's basically the fall 2023 doesn't seem to be on the table anymore, although you know, depending on how the funding decisions move forward in the next couple weeks, maybe that will be back on the table. But an assistant city manager told council this week it would be speculation to try and predict that at this point.
What did the firefighters union president have to say about all this?
Well, he's the one who broke the news to council. It was a little surprising. You know, he was in the public safety committee to talk about the budget and some frustrations he has with, you know, kind of funding over time. And in response to a question about the training center, said, oh, yeah, that's kind of back to the drawing board. And an assistant city manager confirmed that that's what happened. But he's basically saying this is originally allocated $10 million 6 years ago. So the longer it takes, the more expensive construction becomes. And that was kind of the gist of his frustration, is we got to get this started or, you know, this problem's just going to keep perpetuating itself.
Yeah, kind of snowballs. Mm-hmm. I want to have another budget discussion that is more joyful, at least joyful for skaters in town. You reported that Cincinnati's next budget could include money for a skate park. What's going on with that?
That's right. Well, you might remember some of the budget hearings were pretty much dominated by people asking the city to build a skate park. And so we're talking about, you know, the half pipes and things for skateboarders. The Cincinnati Skate Park project Project has been privately fundraising and trying to advocate for this for over a year now. And what's in the, this again, is part of the mayor's kind of separate budget ordinance. It's $250,000. That's not the full cost of the park. So basically, there would need to be private fundraising to raise the rest. It's estimated to cost about $500,000. But the skate park project folks I talked to said they're pretty confident the private funding will come in now that there's this, if this commitment from the city is approved. Again, everything is contingent on council approval, and that won't happen until the next couple weeks.
I get such nervous mom vibes about this. I want there to be like giant pillow forts all around so that people don't get hurt. I know it's not going to be
built. I'll wear my helmet,
please,
Lucy, I promise,
please
when
do.
I go out with my roller skates.
Your brain's so important. Where will this be located?
The final location is still yet to be determined, but it seems like the front runner is near the rec center in Camp Washington.
Okay. And people still have a chance to weigh in on this and other parts of the budget. What are people's opportunities to have a say in all this?
That's right. Well, the last official public hearing is on Monday night at 5:30 p.m. in council chambers at City Hall. Public hearing is just kind of the official term for it, but you can go in person or virtually and give comment. But there's also regular public comment at council meetings. And so there's a regular budget and finance meeting that Monday and the Monday after, as well as the regular council meetings. The closer it gets to final passage, the less likely there will be changes because council needs time to kind of figure things out. There are still opportunities in the next 2 weeks on Mondays and Wednesdays for that public comment.
Okay. Well, I have been talking with WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello and WCPO9 I-Team reporter Paula Christian. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thanks, Lucy.
Up next, we'll talk about the latest in Ohio's race for the U.S. Senate. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. The vote for Ohio's U.S. Senate seat isn't until 2024, but the campaign already is heating up. Joining me now to talk about the latest is USA Today Network Ohio Bureau political reporter Haley B. Miller. Welcome back, Haley.
Great to be here.
Well, we appreciate your being here with us. Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown is running for re-election next year, and a number of GOP candidates have announced they're running against him. Who's announced so far?
So far, we have State Senator Matt Dolan. He's a state senator from Northeast Ohio who ran in the last Senate race when Rob Portman's seat was up. And the other candidate also ran last year in the GOP primary but dropped out. That's Bernie Moreno. He's a Cleveland businessman. He's dabbled in luxury cars, blockchain, things like that. Relative political newcomer, but he's already become a pretty close ally of former President Donald Trump.
And how do those two differ politically?
So Bernie is very much in the Trump lane of the Republican Party, very outspoken about the America First agenda, immigration in particular. His family illegally immigrated from Colombia when he was a child, and he frequently brings that up as he talks about the border security, what's happening at the U.S.-Mexico border. Matt Dolan, a little bit more of a traditional Republican, honestly, in a lot of ways, like Rob Portman, very policy-focused. He's the chairman right now of the State Senate Finance Committee, so he's very involved in the budgeting process and very policy-driven. He has said that after the 22 elections where some Republicans lost in key states or didn't perform as strongly as expected, you know, he has said that the GOP really needs to move on, stop airing campaigns of grievances, which is kind of a knock on the Republicans who were running on fraudulent claims about the 2020 election.
Okay. Another potential candidate was U.S. Representative Warren Davidson, but he announced he won't be running. What happened there?
Yeah, so he said earlier this week that he wanted to focus on his work in the House. He's currently a representative for the 8th Congressional District in Southwest Ohio. His name has come up a lot before for a lot of different races. He was a rumored candidate for governor in 22, and actually his name came up in the Senate race for 22 as well. He was looking very seriously at a Senate bid this time around, enough so that he built a political team and was talking to donors. He would have had the backing of Club for Growth, which is a really prominent conservative group that has been at odds with Trump in recent months, but you know, hard to say for sure. I think it sounds like he is interested in some of the advances he's been making in the House. And he also said too that, you know, the Republicans in the House have a very narrow majority right now, so it's important for him to stay focused on that work. This also makes the primary a lot less messy. So whether that was a consideration for him at all, it's hard to say.
Gotcha. Yeah, we remember how messy the 2022 primary got, that's for sure. Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose has been hinting pretty forcefully about a run. Where does that stand?
He recently told some Republicans in a Lincoln Day dinner that he's hoping to decide one way or another by late summer. In the meantime, he's been raising money for a separate outside group that's casting itself as an election integrity group. It's also doing a lot to kind of tout the work of LaRose's actions as Secretary of State, different policies he supported. That money isn't directly related to any sort of Senate campaign at this point, but that money could theoretically be used down the line if he does end up declaring as a Senate candidate.
Yeah, I thought the story you had on that was really interesting. Tell us a little bit more about how that election integrity group could help with this Senate campaign, or how those two are could be connected.
Yeah, so it's like a really wonky campaign finance thing. So right now, this group is registered as a 527 with the IRS, which means it can advocate for specific issues like election integrity, but it can't raise money for specific candidates. At that point, it would have to register with the Federal Election Commission, which it has not done yet. So right now, this is money being raised under the guise of this broader election integrity issue. But if, for example, LaRose declares as a Senate candidate this summer, what this group could do is take the money that it has raised so far and transfer it to a super PAC that could then help LaRose's candidacy, air ads on his behalf, things like that. So it's all technically legal at this point. But, you know, some people I talked to said this kind of speaks to the problems with the campaign finance system and kind of a post Citizens United world where you have a prospective candidate raising money that could eventually help him down the line.
I see. How common is this method for raising money these days?
It's hard to say for sure. I definitely think it's gotten more common since Citizens United, because that's allowed, you know, businesses, corporations, nonprofits to basically raise as much money as they want. And that's the case with this group. There's no limit on what the money that they can raise right now. So I think, you know, there are a lot of groups doing this more and more, but it's a very, it's a careful, you know, they have to toe the line carefully because it could very easily turn into advocating on behalf of the candidate. And the FEC has cracked down on this in the past. I'm not as sure how recently they've been paying attention to this. Some campaign finance watchdogs say the FEC doesn't do enough to sort of curb this kind of behavior. But, you know, it's just another example of kind of how outside forces are increasingly influencing our elections, I think.
Yeah. Will we know more about where this money is coming from if Secretary of State Frank LaRose finally launches a campaign?
So even if he doesn't launch a campaign, political organizations registered with the IRS like this one, they do have to disclose expenses and contributions, similar to what PACs have to do with the FEC. The only difference is that the disclosures for the IRS aren't quite as transparent, aren't as readily available. The FEC website's pretty easy to operate if you know what you're looking for. So it's a little bit more work to get information about IRS-affiliated organizations, but they say, you know, all this information will be disclosed eventually through the reporting requirements that they have to follow. If it gets transferred to a super PAC, I think that's when it becomes a little more challenging to follow. But we'll see how that plays out.
Gotcha. Well, Senator J.D. Vance has issued an endorsement in the race. Who is he backing at this point and why?
He's backing Bernie Moreno. The two of them have become friends, as far as I can tell. And they're also both close allies of Trump. They both kind of mirror that same America First populist style Republican. And, you know, I think this is someone Vance really wants to work with in the Senate. He also was a victim of an incredibly chaotic primary last year when he finally won the GOP nomination in May. He really spent the following summer picking up the pieces. You know, he got walloped by attacks and, you know, outside groups and things like that. And so he was really struggling with money when he came out of this primary. And that was part of why outside Republican groups had to come in and help him in the fall. So I think, you know, Vance doesn't want to see Moreno or, you know, really any GOP nominee kind of go through the same thing that he went through, because the general election is going to be a lot more competitive. Sherrod Brown, very well recognized throughout the state. He, even Republicans will tell you that he is a formidable Democratic opponent. So Republicans are going to need all the resources they can get in the general election to go up against Brown.
Well, and speaking of Senator Brown, how much does he have to worry? He's, you know, this Democrat in a very, an increasingly red state, a state that, you know, with a lot of Republican political power. How will he appeal to conservative voters, and how big a threat do you think this race is for him?
You know, I think he's going to do what he always does to some extent. He's very good at kind of going to places that Democrats don't usually go to. He's, you know, his Senate office is very good with constituent services, and that's another thing that Republicans recognize. He talks a lot about workers, about trade, and these are issues that really appeal to Ohioans. That's partially why Tim Ryan back in 2022 was hammering a lot of these issues. So I think in some ways he'll use the same formula. It's hard to say how in danger he is. National Republicans have identified Ohio as a top target in 2024. They're going to be funneling a ton of money into Ohio to get Brown out of office. And so that is going to be tough for him. He is going to have to really, you know, go even further with fundraising and campaign even harder than he has before. You know, his supporters will say Brown has faced tough elections before, he can do it again. And I think to some extent, it'll probably depend on who ends up being his opponent and to what extent that person can appeal to the state as well.
Well, and former President Trump won Ohio in the last two presidential elections. Does that mean that Senator Brown needs to win over Trump voters to keep his spot?
Yeah, I definitely think he has to, you know, if not appeal to Trump voters, who are probably pretty hard to move, you know, appeal to some folks in the middle, you know, maybe Republicans who aren't, you know, quite as conservative in certain areas, who maybe aren't America First Republicans. But Trump still does have a, you know, very dedicated base of support here. So I think that's what you're going to hear Brown talking about, you know, things like jobs and trade. And I mean, you do see him doing a fair amount of bipartisan work in the Senate, too. And I think he'll continue to point to, you know, his ability to do that and to work with Republicans when he feels it's good for Ohio.
Yeah. Any word on whether former President Trump is going to make an endorsement in this race?
Not yet. I've heard this mostly just from, you know, reading. I'm not super immersed in Trump world, but I think there's an open question about whether he's going to endorse as many people this time around, since he's running for office himself. If he does endorse, I think it's pretty clear that it's going to be Bernie Moreno. He has developed a close relationship with really the entire family, and Moreno's son-in-law, Congressman Max Miller, up in Northeast Ohio, used to work in the Trump White House. So really tighten it there. A lot of the same ideals as well. And when Moreno entered the race, Trump didn't issue an endorsement, but he spoke favorably about Moreno's decision to run. So I think, you know, it's going to be a matter of whether either Trump is not going to endorse or he's going to endorse Moreno. And I don't see any other prospect of a Trump endorsement for the other candidates.
Do you think that'll have any impact on whether Secretary of State Frank LaRose decides to get into the race?
I don't think so. There have been some comments of his made public recently where he feels that a Trump endorsement doesn't carry the same weight that it used to, or that you certainly, you know, don't need Trump to be a candidate for office in Ohio. I think he is trying to appeal to Trump supporters in some ways. You know, he's really been hitting the issue of election integrity hard in recent months. The Secretary of State's office just launched an election integrity division to kind of investigate potential claims of fraud. So he very much, I think, is trying to ride that middle ground between, you know, Dolan and Moreno, trying to appeal to Trump voters with things like that, but also, you know, touting the fact that he does have, you know, experience in politics. He's been, you know, he was in the state Senate before he was Secretary of State. He probably has the best name ID of the three at this point. And so he has that sort of quote establishment background, but he is trying to speak to other parts of the Republican base as well.
You referenced this a little bit before, but how big a deal do you think this race will be nationwide? I mean, how much will the country be watching this Senate race, and how much national money do you think could get poured into it?
Oh, so much. who knows? I don't know what the magic number is going to be, but I think it's like Ohio, West Virginia, and maybe Montana are the top three targets for Republicans in 2024. Republicans thought that they were going to get control of the U.S. Senate back in 2022, and Democrats were able to hold on to it by the skin of their teeth. Republicans don't want that to happen again, and they see states like Ohio as an opportunity to, you know, kick out some of these incumbents who have been around for a while and try to build that Senate majority so they have, you know, control over more in 2024.
Okay, well, I've been talking with USA Today Network Ohio Bureau political reporter Haley B. Miller. Thanks so much for your time today, Haley. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Up next, a dozen horses have died in just a matter of weeks at Churchill Downs. We'll discuss what racing officials are saying. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. 12 horses have died at Churchill Downs since late April, just before the Kentucky Derby. Now the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Authority has held an emergency meeting about the deaths. Joining me to discuss what horse racing officials are saying and what we know about these deaths is Blood Horse Editorial Director Frank Angst. Thanks for being here, Frank.
Thanks, Lucy.
So a dozen horses have died at Churchill Downs since late April, as I mentioned. How much do these deaths have in common? What do we know about that?
That's the strange thing in this case. The first few that occurred, they clearly occurred for varying reasons. There was a horse that flipped in the paddock, which is the area that they put the saddle on the horse. So that's extremely rare. And while they've done some things to improve safety in the paddock, that's kind of a very much a freak accident. Two horses suffered sudden deaths, which typically end up being heart attacks, but they still have to run necropsies to make sure that's in fact what happened. And of what's a rare subset overall of equine deaths during racing, that's an especially rare corner of that. So a rare subset of that corner. But since then, it's been what we call catastrophic breakdowns. These are injuries to the lower limbs of horses, their legs, their ankles, that unfortunately there's not a way to humanely save the horse. So unfortunately, the best option is euthanasia in that case.
How unusual is it to have this many deaths at one track in such a short time frame?
That's the frustrating thing, because the sport has made strides in this area, but it hasn't in this area of lowering the incidence overall of this. But unfortunately, we still see these spikes on occasion. And I think it's because there are it happens rarely, but there's multifactorial reasons for when it happens. And because of that, it's difficult to quickly discover what's causing this and address it. So unfortunately, what happens is the racing just sort of tightens up in the areas that it is figured out that it has lowered these incidents overall, but it's difficult to quickly discover what the problem is, unfortunately.
You wrote that Churchill Downs had a similar problem a number of years ago. I believe you said that was in 2012. What Yes. factors did you look at? Were there similarities between, you know, weather, rain in 2012 versus compared to this year, that when you kind of Yeah. tried to suss this out?
Yeah, I wrote a column the good thing the industry has done is there is a lot more information out there. Horse racing has really improved at keeping such records. So I just looked at some of those records to look at some of the things that are worth looking at. I can't quite say that any of these are the cause, but I think they're worth looking at. And I heard from several vets that said, yes, these are some of the things they're looking at and racing officials. One is weather. Both in March 2012 and in March 2023, Louisville saw an extreme amount of rain. It was a record year, I believe, in March 2012 and close to record this year. I wrote that down and not even entirely sure of how that would impact the track, you know, basically several weeks later. I will say Churchill has a unique surface. Its dirt track has a clay base underneath. There's several feet of clay that then a foot or so of dirt and clay mix is placed on top of. So maybe it could have some strange link there or perhaps not. Three of the breakdowns occurred in claiming races. Kentucky has put some more money into these events. These are the lower levels of horse racing typically. So we have a lot of horsemen who understand that you never take a chance. But we all, you know, anytime there's money involved and there's more money involved, you would hope, and I can say for a fact that most horsemen wouldn't be influenced by that. If they think there's anything wrong with the horse, they're not going to race the horse. But unfortunately, there's decisions made, and if some people make some wrong decisions and take a chance to run for that money, that should be looked at for sure. And then the third thing that happens is, the third thing I thought worth looking at was the big week of Kentucky Derby. That's a race that everybody wants to race in. So hopefully people are still making decisions that with the horse in mind. Just because you want to race a few days before the Derby, it still has to be the safety of the horse first. And the other thing that happens on that is you have a lot of horses ship into Kentucky from all over the country, to an extent, even all over the world. We had horses from Japan racing the Derby this year. And where that becomes a challenge is racing does pre-race exams by veterinarians. And these are regulatory veterinarians who have no tie to the horse. So they are just looking, they are another layer of protection for the horse. So if you're a veterinarian in Kentucky and you're looking at, if you're seeing the same Kentucky population over and over again, you're going to pick up, you'll just go back to your notes and say, oh, this horse looks different from the last time I saw him. And quite frankly, some of these vets are very good. They're just going to remember the last time. Mm-hmm. But when horses ship in, those vets are looking at horses maybe they've seen for the first time. So they don't have as good of a comparison.
Ah, interesting. So what's happening now to investigate all these deaths?
So there are necropsies, you know, the animal equivalent of an autopsy, to see if anything shows up. That obviously will take some time. Churchill has brought in he's Mick Peterson. He examines tracks throughout the country and he's respected in his field. And he has looked at the track and found it to be safe. Churchill and HISA are a regulatory group. They brought in another track superintendent to also review the track. He hasn't found anything as of yet. Churchill itself has They had sometimes trainers can be rewarded for just starting a horse. It's a low level amount of money, but they took those away just to kind of what I talked about earlier. If some trainer isn't acting in the best interest of the horse, there's less incentive to start the horse now. They are restricting horses that have raced a bunch of times in a short amount of time frame, calendar time. Those horses will not be allowed to race. And there's also, they're going to look at the performance on the track of horses, and horses that have not been racing well in recent races will not be allowed to race.
We have a caller right now. Mary, thanks so much for your call. If you could quickly ask your question or make your point, we sure would appreciate it.
Okay, my point is this. My point is that you can look at the tracks and you can look at the weather. It's like looking at assault weapons for guns and not looking at the Second Amendment. These horses are meant to make money. They're bred for speed. They're not bred for stamina. And over the years, we see more and more breakdowns because these horses just don't have the stamina to run more than a few times without having an injury. Okay. So instead of breeding for speed, I think we have to go all the way back to the breeders and say, just exactly what do you want out of a horse that you're breeding? A really fast horse that can only run a few times to make you some money? Or do you want an animal that has the stamina to live a long and healthy life and race?
Okay. Thanks so much, Mary. Do you think breeding will be something that will be looked at in all this, Frank?
Yeah. Yes, really since about 2009, there's been a huge push to improve the safety of racing. I mean, it was always an interest, but there's been a specific push since 2009. Breeding has been something that's been looked at, and it continues to be looked at. Just to correct the color just a little bit, though, While it feels like there's more of these incidents, and I wish, and everybody in the industry wishes they would be zero, and you know, when these occur around big events like the Kentucky Derby, and we saw one on Preakness Day, that's especially troubling. But the numbers that the industry has and has kept track of, these incidents actually have never been lower in the last 4 years. It's occurring at the lowest rate we've seen.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I appreciate your mentioning that point. Thanks for your call, Mary. So we're running short on time. What's next with all this? Could Churchill Downs be shut down?
I think that's an option because what I said, you know, it takes a while to figure out exactly what's going on. And I think that's an option that definitely has to be considered and just give everybody a pause to just really... I think most horsemen are always aware to be at the safest. Track officials are understanding that safety has to be first, but maybe that pause reminds everybody, you know, just another reminder in that regard.
Well, I've been talking with Blood Horse Editorial Director Frank Angst. Thank you so much for your time today, Frank. You've been so informative. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks, Lucy.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Derek Smith. If you miss our program live, you can subscribe to Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.